Welcome to the Your Voice podcast, brought to you by ebodyguard.org and the eBodyguard app, available wherever you buy apps. Your Voice is a podcast empowering women to become a victor over victimization. We're changing the conversation about domestic violence and victims of trauma in America. This is Your Voice with hosts Melissa Faith Hart and Melissa Moore.
Hi, it's Melissa Moore along with Melissa Faith Hart, and this is the Your Voice podcast. And today we're excited to talk with the Chief of Police for Red Rocks Community College there in Lakewood, Colorado, and that is Sean Duga. And good morning to Melissa. Good morning, Sean. How are you guys doing?
Great.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Well, thank you for being here. Melissa, you want to start off for us?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Chief, for joining us today with our domestic violence podcast, where we are changing our conversation. And specifically, we're going to jump right in and talk about the 911 process. And with domestic violence, many times we have sex assault. And during the 911 call, Chief, I was wondering if you could talk to us about the step-by-step process of what occurs when police services show up and are called to support. What happens during that process?
So the phone call comes in, and generally a 911 operator could be a generic 911 operator, or they could be associated with the local police jurisdiction. And they'll screen that call to law enforcement to give them some basics of what occurred. And then up to the point of even asking if medical attention is needed. But when law enforcement arrives, that's probably the first thing they're going to do is ask whether or not medical attention is needed. And then once they establish that, they'll determine if there in fact was a crime. Was there a sexual assault and where it occurred? And if it was at home, they'll want to identify the precise area and make arrangements to get lab technicians there so that a potential evidence can be collected, including any clothing that was worn at the time of the assault.
And Chief, what happens if it is a rape situation that happened on a date, happened outside of the home, but the person didn't call until they got back to their home?
Well, and that's very common. You know, maybe they've talked to a confidant, or they had some concerns about calling initially. And so they make the phone call. Police will ask where it occurred. It wasn't at the residence. But one of the things they'll ask to comfort victims is to see, number one, if they need medical attention. Number two, if they'd like to have a victim advocate present for the process. And then identify if there is any evidence to collect. And they'll have a discussion about whether or not the victim wants to pursue, based on the information the officers are given, if they want to pursue any criminal charges.
So In your experience, what percentage of these victims will be able to come forward and ask for support to law enforcement for sex assault crimes?
You know, sadly, in my experience and from what I've read over many, many years in law enforcement, over 30 plus years in law enforcement, we believe we're only hearing from anywhere from 20 to 25% of victims in these cases. So we know reporting is very low, and obviously we'd like to change that.
What do you believe is the reason that the percentage is so low, Chief?
You know, I think one of the things is there's a lot of stigma and shaming associated with reports of sex assault. Victims don't feel like they'll be believed. Somehow they blame themselves for getting put or placed in a situation that where they may have made a mistake. Maybe they didn't make a mistake, but maybe they feel like they did make a mistake and they're going to be criticized for that. And so there's a lot of shaming that's associated, self-blame is the term, with victims not wanting to report. And they oftentimes hide these incidents from their family and friends. They don't want their family and friends to know about it either. So it's quite common.
I have heard different victims say that a lot of times they feel like the process, they feel like they get victimized twice.
Yeah. So there's a lot of things involved in that, you know, and we're still not in law enforcement collectively across the country. We're not all on the same page with how these investigations should be conducted, you know, in the interest of comforting the victims. That's where we start. That's number one, because you don't want to re-victimize someone. And, you know, you need to find out if they want to cooperate with the investigation. And then we have learned, we found that the more honest we can be with victims about the process, you know, if they want to be examined by a nurse that specializes in sex assault, what that's going to look like, we will prepare them for that. And generally, if we have a female officer, a female investigator, or a female victim advocate, we found we've had good success with educating our victims on what that's going to look like. Instead of a victim being brought into a room with a female victim being brought into a room with three or four male police or investigators and being asked to tell their story, there's some re-victimization associated with that environment. So we do our best to try to minimize that as best we can. And we found through educating the victim as best we can about next steps in the process, that goes a long way.
So I want to take this a little bit further, because I see that you recognize that re-victimization does happen in the process. And you said that you're not all on the same page from a national perspective, and probably from even a statewide perspective, you're not on the same page. I've walked through the process myself, and re-victimization was something I experienced. Mm. If you could change how the system responded to sex assault crime, what would you change and why?
Well, if I was put in charge, there's a number of things I would do. And while I do believe there's been some improvements made, I think we still have a long way to go in this country for treating our victims better and doing a better job investigating these crimes. So one of the things, the first thing I would do if we could make changes and I was running the process, I would guarantee to the victim that their identity would never be disclosed. Number one, some states have already done this, but not all. And then probably the second part of that is I'd make sure we would, with the victim's consent, have them interviewed with a video so that we could use the video in lieu of their in-person testimony in court. This is done with many juvenile sex assault victims, young children, especially. They play excerpts of the video in court. Are not subject to cross-examination. And that's what I think our adult victims, female victims, fear is that cross-examination. I think next I'd probably ensure that all interviews of victims are done by a member of the same sex, and ideally just once. I'd assign a full-time victim advocate to the victim so they can stay with them throughout the entire process. So they always have someone to call when they don't know what's going on, someone to go with them to court each and every time they go. And probably the last part of that is, and this is something I've experienced personally in my career, is I would make it a requirement that the victim must be advised and must agree. So two points there, two prong, must be advised and must agree to any plea bargain offer. I've had a number of victims in my experience, cases that I've been involved in or my division of investigations have been involved in, where the victims felt like they weren't treated very well, they weren't considered, a plea bargain was given to the suspect without even, identifying what the victim wanted to do or how the victim felt about that. And that's all part of that re-victimization, where they felt like they weren't valued enough to get their opinion on some offer that was on the table to the suspect. So right off the top of my head, those five or six points, I think, would go a long way to making this a less traumatic process for victims.
And Chief, one of the things I want you to help me understand from a law enforcement perspective is, and you hear about this in the news all the time, you have a woman saying, "I was raped." You have the guy saying, "It was consensual. Yes, we had sex." And all of a sudden, it truly is the classic, he said, she said. How do you shake that out from a law enforcement perspective to get to the truth?
You know, that's a great question. And it's something that law enforcement continues to deal with. You know, victims struggle enough with being believed, and because of this, they certainly do. And there's other reasons. You know, we know research tells us that answer, there's no clear-cut answer to that. It's complicated. There's a wide range of reasons people don't report their experiences with sexual harassment and assault. And they hide them from family and friends because of the self-blame. And the other part of this is we know the suspects have rights. The victim is more than likely to give us their story and tell us the details of what it transpired. And it takes a very savvy investigator to sit down and interview a suspect so that they can collect that information from them before they decide to get legal representation, which is their right. So that starts with the Miranda advisement of rights, and that person is not compelled to talk. So in many instances, we're dealing with one side of the story, and the other side, we may have very little information. And so how we develop the other side of that is by doing a thorough investigation. Are there injuries to the victim? Is there evidence of an assault? Getting some background, unfortunately, background on both of those people. But injuries, unfortunately, the presence of injuries goes a long way to substantiating the allegations made by the victim. It will continue to be a problem. When you add alcohol to the equation, drugs and alcohol, those are all things that make these cases very, very difficult for law enforcement. And we truly try to get to the bottom of and try to get away from the he said, she said, because you're right, it's problematic. And victims, many cases, don't feel like they're going to be believed. And so which presents a reluctance to come forward. And that's the thing we're trying to overcome.
I was just getting ready to say, I would think that the drugs, the alcohol, I mean, unfortunately, you've heard this, I've heard this as well. It was rough sex. That's why there's injuries. And there's all sorts of excuses out there where the victim finally says, yeah, I was drinking. I had a couple of glasses of wine. And all of a sudden they feel like because of that, which isn't illegal, their case, their, validity gets thrown out.
Right. Exactly. So evidence collection is critical to these cases. You know, victims, I've dealt with many, many in my career. They get caught up in how TV and media has falsely portrayed victims having to go to court and testify and go through the shaming invasion into their private lives in a courtroom setting. They're thinking about all these things way ahead of even getting to that point when many of these cases never make it to trial. They don't want to be exposed to embarrassment. They don't want their reputation sullied, and they don't want their private life scrutinized. And if they made a poor choice that actually got them into the situation, they don't want to be blamed for it. It really goes back to no means no. And no means I don't give consent. And that's the law. And so we try to reassure victims that these things are possible. These things could happen. But, we will do our best on the other end to collect as much evidence we can against the suspect to hold them accountable. And that's where we tend to fall short, frankly.
So when it comes to the evidence gathering process, it sounds like it's a very careful process for you to sort through the victim's story, the suspect's story, and then be able to provide that entire story to the district attorney and sometimes state's attorney so that then they can present that story to a jury. In the case of the he said, she said, what do you feel when it comes to the evidence gathering process is really important for the law enforcement officer to be able to conduct their job the best? What do you feel will help moving forward to sort through that evidence gathering process the most?
We learn in these cases, evidence is very fragile. If victims were sexually assaulted and they showered, many misunderstand that there's no longer any evidence, which we've learned is not necessarily true. So that's always been, well, if you've showered, there's no evidence to be collected. That's not necessarily true. It's very important to collect the clothing that was worn. We do forensic examinations of clothing, of tears in clothing, of any bodily fluids that could be left on clothing, anywhere from saliva to semen. And so the rape kit is very critical. These are professional, they call them SANE nurses out in Colorado. I think a lot of states do. That stands for sexual assault nurse examiner. And they're very, very good about making this as much of a, for lack of a better term, painless or seamless process as possible, understanding the needs of the victim and what they've just been through. So that rape kit is collected, and that kit is provided to law enforcement. Chain of custody is preserved, and it goes into evidence and out to the crime lab so it can be examined. Interviewing of the victim is very important, and holding the victim, trying to maintain a story, understanding that if they're not ready to do that, maybe they need some time. We've learned that sometimes the best recount you have of a traumatic episode is between 24 and 48 hours after it occurred, after maybe two sleep cycles. I don't know how much victims sleep during those 2 days, but that's what we've learned, is you have better recollection. And so trying to interview the victim one time with the most recollection they have is also critical, so their story can't be attacked by defense attorneys or whoever. And so that's important. And again, we only have the victim in many cases. Sometimes maybe they didn't know the suspect, or they only knew him by a name. And so time passes while we can only gather information from the victim and try to put a case together before we even have a chance to talk to a suspect. And once we do, he's either going to talk to us or he's going to get a lawyer and not talk to us. So very, very difficult. But we do our best to preserve as much evidence, take photographs of the victim. The same nurse takes care of that. Take photographs of any crime scene, if it happened anywhere in a car, anywhere they could take us back to where it occurred, to try to collect as much evidence as possible to support the victim.
And Chief, walk me through the process. How does this process look different when you're called in to a domestic violence call at a house, and it's a husband and wife, and the wife is claiming sexual abuse, sexual assault?
So in that situation, in a domestic situation, what law enforcement should be doing, first of all, is separating the male and the female, if we're talking about a male and female couple. So separating the two parties and then establishing whether or not there's been a crime that occurred. And if we can establish that early on, now all laws aren't the same, but in the state of Colorado, if you go to a domestic situation and if any probable cause exists for any crime that occurred, not just sex assault, not just harassment, any crime, intimidation, anything like that, force, things like that, there's a mandatory arrest associated with that by Colorado revised statute. So we can get the male into custody, at least get him somewhere else where we can spend some time with the victim. I've had a lot of success in my career getting a victim advocate out to talk to traumatic victims that can't talk to male officers. Most police departments, they're lucky to have 10% of their staff as 10% of their staff as female officers. So there's a good chance you may not even have a male that responds to the scene. And then if you're going to call detectives to the scene, that may take a couple hours. Victim advocates come out a little quicker. So in many cases, you can get a female out, victim advocate. And I've had a lot of success with female advocates, finding out what happened, finding out if we had a crime, getting the victim to open up to them, and then say, okay, we have something here. So now let's see what we can do to try to prove this case. So, difficult situation, but it starts with getting them apart. And if there's enough to make an arrest, the victim doesn't have to press charges in the state of Colorado in a domestic. The officers are mandated to arrest if they have any evidence that and any probable cause to believe a crime's occurred. So that can go a long way to getting them separate. Go ahead.
Okay, Chief. So let me clarify that comment again. If you are called out to a domestic violence situation, and there is you're certain that there, or you're pretty certain that a crime has been committed, sexual or not, someone is going to be arrested in the state of Colorado.
You bet. That's absolutely correct. And statistics show that 90% of offenders are male.
Okay. That's nationwide. Why, because I feel like there's been some disclaimer over the years as, is there going to be somebody arrested if a call is made and the police are called to the house and there's an accusation? Is there going to be somebody arrested?
And so what, a number of years ago, the state of Colorado changed. They, for lack of a better term, they limited officer discretion in making arrests or not making arrests in domestic violence situations, because many years ago, when I was a young police officer, we would go to domestics. We would referee an argument. we would separate them if we could for the evening, and that would be it. And then we started to see over the years, sometimes victims, female victims were re-victimized. The male went to a friend's house to sleep it off, decided not to, came home, assaulted the victim, or worse. Mm-hmm. And so that's when the decision was made. The driving force was, we cannot let women be re-victimized in these domestic situations. What can we do? Well, mandatory arrest. Put them in jail, no bond, until they talk to a judge. So they're held on no bond in the state of Colorado until they talk to a judge.
Awesome. I did not realize that.
Yes.
So what are the levels of consequences if you arrest them for a DV, a domestic violence charge? Can you walk us through that?
So if they're arrested, they're held on no bond until they're arraigned and advised of their rights. And then the judge will initiate a standing restraining order based on the level of what had occurred, you know. And the victim in the state of Colorado, in many jurisdictions anyway, judicial districts, is subpoenaed to go to court to meet with a victim advocate, so that they can ensure that we get their side of the story into what happened. Many victims, as you can imagine, are reluctant to file charges against their spouses for any given number of reasons. Sole source of financial support, father of their children, maybe the mother of the children doesn't work, whatever. And so there's a reluctance there. And so the courts have taken that out of the females or the victim's hands and made mandatory arrest. So the suspect gets arraigned. There may be, depending on the circumstances, there may be an order to stay away from the victim. If it's aggravated, the judge could arraign them and then order a bond amount. It could be, you know, anywhere from $1,000 to $10,000 to maybe try to ensure that the suspect stays in jail for a period of time. But the mandatory arrest and the no bond is sort of a cooling off period for suspects. If they're arrested on a Friday, it's very likely they won't see the judge till Monday. And in many of those circumstances, things cool down and then they're able to get out and behave themselves. So that initial temporary restraining order is issued, and then the victim can work with the victim advocate to get that extended through the court based on any continual threatening behavior on the part of the suspect.
So you talked about the consequences being both financial, could be both financial and also jail time, in order to be able to have this sort of cooling down period. And in the process, the victim is supported by law enforcement or the judicial system, because you've learned that that is a lot of pressure to place on the victim at this Absolutely. Time, whether it's a financial reason or they might be caught in the cycle of abuse. Can you walk us through what those supportive services look like from the judicial system, what they can look like?
Right. So, you know, so it's really key. We have found really key that if an agency is small, like I have a small police agency, we don't have a victim advocate on staff. And so we contract with the county, Jefferson County, for victims advocates, or the city of Lakewood is always willing to send us a victim advocate should we need one. Many police agencies have their own on staff depending on their size. And so that's so critical to put a victim advocate, because they can walk a victim through and answer any questions they have about the process. And then they can also provide additional opportunity for resources. Maybe there's a Department of Mental Health component where the victim is obviously dealing with some anxiety and some mental health issues that they can refer them to. And sometimes that can be out of the one incident, or it could have been something that could have been sustained over a long period of time. And that's why the victim advocates are so critical. Police can do it too, but victim advocates tend to get more out of victims and find out really what makes them tick and what really occurred, more so than a line level police officer, or even a detective for that matter. And so there's mental health services available. And then again, having that working with the victim in that victim outreach scenario, to let them know that this is my number. This is the number you can call. Always reach me at 24/7, and having that person, because even during the time of a traumatic episode, victims aren't really thinking about you that's not the time to talk about what the court process looks like. We're going to go meet with the city or we're going to meet with this county attorney. That's not the time. It's immediate assistance, medical, maybe mental health, and certainly any other support. Maybe it's financial support to help them get another place. Maybe they have to leave their apartment and go somewhere else. Maybe they have children and they're concerned about getting their children somewhere safe. And there are those resources in the county and at the state through the victim advocates and through the state of Colorado here to provide some financial assistance for victims to help them financially, at least temporarily, get away from out of their situation.
Tell me this, how long do victims have to report a crime?
It really depends on, every crime has a statute of limitations. So minor misdemeanors are generally, we can prosecute within 6 months, but for felony type cases, it could be years. If they witnessed hypothetically a homicide, there's no statute of limitations on a homicide. They could report it 10 years later. So it could depend on the nature of the crime, but if it's a sex assault or something like that, I think in the state of Colorado, it's a 5-year statute of limitations that at least law enforcement needs to be notified.
Well, and the reason that I ask you that, Chief, is in this era of Me Too, where women are finally coming forward saying, hey, yeah, that happened to me too. Hey, yeah, that Bill Cosby or whatever we want to say happened with somebody like that, and it had been years ago. That's where I was wondering what the recourse is for those women.
I think all states are different too with statute of limitations. And as I recall, there were some victims that came forward in the Cosby case whose even though they were believable, there was a lack of evidence. And, time does make evidence go stale. Mm-hmm. Makes it more difficult to prove. And then you have naysayers who say, why did you wait so long? Well, there's a lot of reasons victims wait so long, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but please make the report and then let's find out if it's something we can pursue. But I think most of the cases, the several women that Bill Cosby being convicted, well, those were more recent cases than some of the other ones. But he had, as we know, dozens of victims over a long period of time.
I do want to bring up one question. So, Chief, you are familiar with the eBodyguard app. What do you think the difference will be in what we can do with the eBodyguard app and a he said, she said?
Well, we're excited about that. This is breaking technology. It's been, with through eBodyguard, we've adopted it on our campus. The ability to trigger a voice-activated alarm alert and start recording something that's going on. Making a 911 call when you're not able to do it and tracking your location by GPS is unprecedented, certainly in my 38-year law enforcement career, and unprecedented in this country. And I'm hoping with the advances of that type of technology through eBodyguard helps instill a little bit more courage in our victims to feel like they have some support. This did happen. They will be believed. And it gives them the evidence, the crucial evidence that we need as law enforcement to prosecute these types of difficult crimes, because we really want to prosecute these people that victimize women. We really want to do that. And it will take all the evidence we can get. And this is certainly going to help law enforcement to that end.
Well, Chief of Police with Red Rocks Community College, Sean Dugan, thank you so much for being here today. Melissa Faith Hart, Melissa Moore, it is the Your Voice podcast. We appreciate all of your time.
Well, thank you very much. You have a great day.
For more information on domestic violence and trauma issues, visit ebodyguard.org. The eBodyguard app is available at the Apple Store and Google Play. For help 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the domestic violence hotline can be reached at 1-800-799-SAFE.
Your Voice podcast is presented by the Public Affairs and News Department of Bonneville, Denver. Thank you for listening.